Hey folks, welcome back to The Ferment. I'm Marcus Peter Rempel. It's good to have you back for another conversation around the work of Ivan Illich. Today, a conversation improvised mostly by Sam Ewell and Dugald Hine. I really love the way this conversation starts moving us from engaging with Illich as someone who has powerful ideas for our time to someone who can suggest open a road to some practices for our time. You'll notice that in my improvised introduction, I wanted to highlight some words, some threads that had been opened up by both Dugald and Sam, and in trying to quote Sam, I was quoting an email from Sam, but the ideas I was pulling out were something that Sam had quoted from Dugald, and so Sam very graciously found a way to correct my misattribution without finding any fault with me and throwing the ball to Dugald in a lovely, gracious way that I'm sure speaks to his abilities as a community organizer. So grateful for that. Thanks for catching that, Sam, and thanks everyone for joining us. If you like what's happening here at The Ferment and you want to chip in, I encourage you to find us at Patreon. If you go to the website at theferment.ca, there's a button there that'll take you to the place where you can donate. Likes on your whatever app you're using to listen to the podcast, those certainly help too. I think, yeah, without any further ado, I give you a conversation improvised between Sam and Dugald and some really interesting other voices that join us towards the end, including Claudio, who is a friend of Sam's who originally introduced him to the work of Illich. That was a lovely way to round out the conversation of friends talking about someone who taught a lot about friendship. Enjoy. Peace and all good. Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon or good evening, wherever you are. Or almost good night, I suppose, for some. I see your eyebrows going up there, Dugald. Thanks for being with us, whatever time you're carving out of your day. I'll keep the introductions fairly brief. If you're with us today, you probably have connected with this conversation and the people who are part of it significantly already. We're really grateful to have a time today with Sam Ewell and Dugald Hine. I've been really grateful the way these conversations have been more and more putting their roots into the ground that we're living in and on. As time has gone on, and I wonder as a place to begin, maybe I'm thinking of some threads that we left in the last conversation and the one before that. I'm thinking about particularly a framing that you offered, Dugald, of the Austrian politician who said of Illich, I'm guessing he said this in German, mit dem kann man nichts machen. You can't do anything with this guy. In contrast with the people in the barrio who felt like with this one, we can do something, in contrast to, you know, all these other clever philosophers and writers who have been concerned with questions of social justice that one would hope would land in the barrio. You had an example of a friend who found Illich particularly fitting. So I'm curious to have a conversation about the places where Illich's work lands,
the soil that his work can help us tend and grow. And in the emails back and forth, Sam, you shared some thoughts around horror and wonder, and the sense of being called not to fix things, but to play our part. And I would love it if we come away from the conversation today with a sense of the difference between feeling the Promethean temptation to fix things versus a humbler calling to do our part, and an awareness of both the wonders and the horrors that Illich would want us to and can help us to attend in the present moment. I haven't thought of who to throw that to first, so I'll just throw that to the two of you. I know you're very capable and generous conversationalists. I think we'll look forward to mostly just listening in. I might throw in a prompt here or there in the next hour, and then after the hour, David Benjamin will pump the brakes a little bit and make sure that some other voices have some on ramps, and then we'll spend another half an hour together that way. So over to you.
I have a suggestion, Dougal. May I set you up? Can I just put the ball to you, man? Just riffing on some of those words from Marcus, about this temptation to fix crises or others or ourselves versus how we play our part. When one of the ways that I summarized what I learned from Illich in Brazil is that he helped shine light on two kind of rival versions of human flourishing. In one version, it is this kind of Promethean human flourishing is simply a technical problem that must be fixed. The alternative is a relational possibility to be shared. That's, I think he's shown that light. And then you shared some words earlier this week on social media, Dougald. I'll just quote them back to you if that's all right, man. You shared, the world is woven through with horror. We are reminded of this the moment we switch on our phones. Yet it is also woven through with wonder. And we need to be reminded of this too. For if we let in the horror without letting in the wonder, then it will leave us broken, unable to play our part. And it was that note, man, where you landed on able to play our part, not the hubris of we're the only players or the only agents. It's up to us to fix, but at the same time, not the despair or the indignity of thinking we have no agency. And so since the conversation last time was between me and David Cayley, I'd love to just give you the space to kind of take that where you want to go.
Around Thanks, Sam. Part.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's good to be back with you all. And yeah, to get to pick up, having listened to the conversation that you and David had 2 weeks ago, and the questions that were carried forward from that. And yeah, it's, you know, I feel like a lot of my work at the moment is looking for ways of naming and making an invitation to agency of a different kind to that Promethean agency, which almost ends up with a radical monopoly, in Illich's terms, on what acting in the world might look like within the logics of modernity. I'm reminded of an old friend of mine, Anthony McCann, one of the folks who I was reading Illich with when I was still in my 20s. And Anthony will sometimes say, you know, the way that we often define power makes it something we wouldn't want to have. If we define power as the ability to control, to manipulate, to dominate, then the risk is that if we're not drawn to those things, then we have made ourselves powerless. And I think I've noticed this in different ways in the writing that I've been doing around modernity and sort of traveling with Vanessa Machado de Oliveira and her hospicing modernity work, that I sometimes say, you know, modernity has kind of bequeathed us an understanding of what is involved in acting effectively in the world that is made in the image of a certain picture of God. And so, you know, step one is omniscience, knowing the world from above. We need the kind of knowledge on the basis of which to make plans. And then step two is omnipotence. And you know, a theologian who I was in conversation with about this a while ago said, yes, well, of course, you know, that idea of, you know, the way that God knows the world being some kind of detached from above, zoomed out thing is also part of the mess. But if we give up on the kinds of projects of power and agency that someone like James C. Scott described the history and failure of in his book, Seeing Like a State, which is very much that kind of attempting to know from above and then find the ways of acting on the world. If we give up on that, or if we invite people to give up on that, it can sound like an invitation to give up, full stop. It can sound like an invitation to powerlessness. And I think that in the story of the Austrian politician that Marcus mentioned, there is that reaction to Illich is coming from within the kinds of agency that one is meant to take seriously if one is seeking and acquiring power within political systems as they exist in the world today. And it can be hard to see from there that there might be another kind of agency that isn't simply powerlessness. And that, you know, one way that I talk about that other kind of agency is creating conditions of possibility, or seeking to contribute to the conditions of possibility, noticing what becomes possible, what ceases to be possible, what becomes more likely, what becomes less likely as a consequence of the way I'm showing up in relation with the others who I am alongside or in different ways in relation with. And as I'm saying this, I'm thinking of another place where this echoes in Illich's thinking, which is, there are several essays that he wrote in the early 1980s that could be worth revisiting at this moment in time, where he's writing about peace.
Yeah.
And he's writing about that partly through his involvement in the anti-nuclear movement in West Germany in the early 1980s. And there's one essay in particular, which I believe was delivered originally as a talk in Japan, where he's talking about the three dimensions of peace. And he's talking about the culturally specific nature of our understandings and experiences of peace and our language of peace. But there's one bit in there where he talks about the difference between the peace of the center and the peace of the edges. He says the peace of the center is peacekeeping, peacemaking. It's a seeking to have control. It's the Pax Romana, the Pax Economicum. He says the peace of the edges is the longing to be left in peace. It's the desire to be able to get on with life in community in the places where we find ourselves without being on the receiving end of those power projects that are emanating from the center. I suppose one more thing to to throw into the beginning of today's conversation, I think, you know, part of the invitation to us, Sam, is to talk tonight about Illich and his relevance for those of us who might sometimes, for want of a better word, be called practitioners. Mm. That is, you know, Illich, not just for thinking and doing theory, but for practice, for finding agency, for finding things that are worth doing, for finding ways to play a part without attempting to be the one writing the script and knowing the whole shape of the wider drama that we're thrown into. And I think I remember having this conversation with Alistair McIntosh, actually, where he was wondering whether Illich, and he met Illich, he was wondering whether Illich wasn't, you know, in some ways too negative a thinker to be that helpful for action. And I think that's worth drawing out, because he's not wrong in noticing a negative quality as something, perhaps even something defining about Illich's thinking. And I mean, in David Cayley's book, he draws attention to the places where Illich says, you know, I'm a proscriptive thinker, not a prescriptive thinker. You know, the things that arise from my thinking are setting of limits and boundaries, not telling you what to do and what needs to be done. And I think that negativity, you know, while going back to the conversation 4 weeks ago with David, I tend to slightly disagree with David over the extent to which Illich is doing theology in the rivers north of the future. I tend to take his claim to be speaking as a historian more at face value than I think David does. But nonetheless, I think that kind of the principle of negativity in Illich's thinking certainly has a, you know, more than a trace of a kind of via negativa tradition, theologically speaking, to it. But it's worth differentiating from something that I think a lot of people have encountered and been frustrated with in late 20th and early 21st century academia, in, you know, in certain fields at any rate, which is a kind of self-satisfaction with critique as an end in itself.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a lot of us have had one version or another of an encounter with that, where it's almost as if, you know, the job has been done when you've done the deconstruction. What do you mean? You want to be able to, you know, reconstruct. I remember Mary Harrington and I, in our years after Oxford, sort of helping each other through the mess that had done to us, which was the years in which I discovered Illich. And it was Mary who first came with this amazing image of, you know, our education was one half of a shamanic initiation. And whatever body of truth we might have thought we were bringing when we arrived, we were taught how to cut it to pieces, but no responsibility was taken for the sense that we might then need to be able to make a new body on the Right. far side of that deconstruction in order to, you know, make sense of what is to be done with a life. So we had to sort of figure that out for ourselves. And so Illich is not a negative thinker in the sense of being satisfied with that place where you've deconstructed everything. That's definitely not, you know, you never end up at the void which that can lead to with Illich. What you end up with is the kind of the mystery, you know, the faith that he is very reticent about wanting, about attaching words to, but very clear about its centrality for him. And then maybe we can, you know, we'll come back to this in the rest of this session. The way to see what the kind of, if you like, what the photographic print that might arise from the negative of Illich's thought looks like is to look at the people he was closest to who were acting in the world and see what that looked like. So maybe we can come to some examples of that as we go on today. But I mean, that's more than enough for me to put on the table to get us started, Sam. I mean, over to you. What is it that you'd like to pick up on from within that as an opening?
There's so much. And I think I was really struck by how you talked about agency from above and seeing and how much it matters. Like, you know, what's the lens? How are you, you know, where are you positioned? And just to loop back, and I spoke last time, and I think, you know, you might be familiar with this story because I've told it many times about how I personally encountered Illich as an American missionary in Brazil. And it was through my friend Claudio, who's on this call. Shout out to Claudio. He's here tonight. He introduced me to Illich. So I was introduced to Illich in the most Illichian of ways by a friend who became my older brother in Brazil. And I wanted to start with that personal narrative to kind of put a bit of texture on what you're getting at with the no that you hear in Illich and the mystery that's of the yes. Because, you know, when you think about Illich as a negative thinker, and you referenced his writings in the 80s on economic peace and his criticism of the development paradigm. Whoa, you know, the air I breathed growing up, these were what Illich would call certainties, right? These were just assumptions about the way the world has unfolded for the good of the world. And so I wasn't naive about that, but at the same time, well, I was conditioned. I had an invisible backpack on, let's put it that way, when I went to Brazil, of assumptions. But it was in reading, you know, when Illich wrote that and directed that 1968 talk, To Hell with Good Intentions, to, let's say there were gap year students and sort of, you know, short-term gap years in 1968. Well, I was already in Brazil when I read that. So I wasn't there on a gap year. You know, I married a Brazilian. We were building a life. So there was a lot of texture into how I got to Brazil. But at the same time, you know, Illich ends that talk he called that influx of Americans, particularly in the 60s, a benevolent invasion of volunteer armies. That's strong, right? And he's talking to Peace Corps, not just Christian missionaries, but like it was a benevolent invasion in the development decade. And he ends that talk saying, come to walk in the hills, come to learn the songs, come to learn Spanish, come to enjoy the beauty, but please do not come to help. That's the no. That's the prescription. That's the limit. Because why? Because you need to, the mystery is that you've crossed a threshold. The mystery is that there's an encounter to be had. And if you come with that backpack without wearing it, you know, knowing that you have it on, and you try to pull out in a kind of Santa Claus way all of your cultural gifts that you think they need, then it's like walking through someone's door without even knocking and being asked to enter, right? And that, so that was my encounter. It was kind of hearing the no of Illich. But if I could just stay with that no, you know, because I'm imagining a lot of people on this call haven't actually read that. And I just wanted to give this one little excerpt of me describing that. So Illich, you know, wrote this critique of development, the critique of the benevolent invasion. I'm actually here, I just wanted to read this little bit. Illich says development had a birthday, right? It was, development isn't just this kind of universal generic sense of things unfolding. Development, as he and others came to see it, was a geopolitical strategy that was post-World War II. And, you know, and he links it to President Truman's four-point plan. I just want to read this bit to kind of zoom out. It is difficult to exaggerate just how ambitious Truman's developmentalist vision truly was. But as Arturo Escobar, a Colombian anthropologist and Illichian collaborator, suggests, Truman's speech position development as the project of universalizing the American dream. And here's the quote. In Truman's vision, capital, science, and technology were the main ingredients that would make this massive revolution possible. Only in this way could the American dream of peace and abundance be extended to all people of the planet. No. That's what Illich is saying no to. So I just wanted to kind of frame that also as someone who I grew up with the American dream. And, you know, that's 4th of July, the whole, all of that national ritual around that. And it's not that I believed in it as gospel, but what Illich is saying is, let's call it what it is. This platform is trying to universalize, to export the American way of life and call it peace. And that's what he's saying no to. So I think it's just really helpful to see where the no is coming from, because it's also destroying, as you say, other people's option to say, leave us in peace. We've listened to this land. We know our neighbors.
Yes.
Right? That's what it crushes. And so there's the no, and then you talked about to see Illich as a prescriptive thinker. He spent a lot of time trying to clear the ground as a kind of iconoclast might be another way. So he's clearing space for mystery, trying to make room for that incarnational threshold to reemerge, to be connected. So I think that's just one thing. And we could, you know, we're reading Illich and having this conversation in the context of current events where, you know, everyone's trying to reimagine what agency and peace looks like. And it's so visible in our face what it's not, what it's not. And so I think one thing that really strikes me, and maybe I'll this can be a transition back to you, is I talked about what it meant, hearing that no in Illich, and then it made me curious. It took a while for me to get a sense of what's he for? So if you think about, you know, you talked about Illich, let's not put him in the same room at the same table with just a kind of postmodern fetish of the critique, right? Of the dismantling. There's the opposition, what you oppose, especially when a world has been imposed on you, which is what he's saying no to. But what are you for? You know, what does that yes look like in Illich? And what kind of space for agency that we often don't see does he try to make room for? So I think about how I encountered friends in Brazil. And I use a Portuguese word, virada. I'll just type it here in the text box. Virada is a turning point moment. It's the virada. And it's not it's not a religious term, but, you know, it's the plot twist. But it's that converting moment. And actually, Gustavo Esteva tells his, there's an online article where he talks about as três viradas, you know, in his life. And what I'm curious about is virada for me became a way of naming, with all of the cultural conditioning and formation of being a white male American in Brazil and reading Illich and then hearing no to a certain vision of imposing a way of life and slowly beginning to see, didn't happen overnight, but another way, what he calls people's peace, a way of belonging, a way of being there without just casting yourself in the role of helper in a Promethean sense. A yes began to emerge. But you talk about it, Zugwood, you shared some writing earlier this week about Illich, reading Illich as the depth charge, which I think resonates for me with the virada. You know, there's something, and maybe you can explain a little bit about that. And then I thought one way we could kind of literally ground this conversation is a lot of my practical work. You know, I don't walk around saying I'm a practitioner of Illich, but yes, I mean, the way I live my life is related to tending relationships in a neighborhood, making soil gardening. So there's this kind of food cycle my imagination has been turned towards those particularities through Illich. And through the lens of the Promethean lens, that kind of agency, that kind of growing food at a neighborhood, household, street, neighborhood scale, through the Promethean lens, that doesn't count. That's not quantifiable. And it you know, it's just it's not significant. And yet, one thing that I found fascinating about your that quote where you say, when Illich says, all through history, the best measure for bad times was the percentage of food eaten that had to be purchased. That's the depth chart. When you measure, when you have to buy all your food, you know you're struggling. This is, and so I just wanted to invite you to kind of magnify that. How do you follow Illich and that quote into a space where we leave a Promethean industrial food chain as the only way to connect with our food and neighbors and enter into some other space?
Right. It's such a great example, that, because that's one of those one sentence depth charges in Illich's work. And you know, it's partly because what it confronts you with, I mean, Illich used to talk about the mirror of the past, how we can become aware of our strangeness through an attentive relation to the past. And that's really the historical version of what is also there as a kind of cultural thing within Illich all along, which is that when we encounter the other and shut up for long enough and listen hard enough, then we learn something we didn't know about ourselves. And I mean, you know, I've been thinking this week about conversion and conversation as a pairing of words, which, you know, your virada also kind of, you know, conversation is when we're turning backwards and forwards, we're turning something around together. You know, I pass it to you and you look at it and you see something, you turn it to a different angle to the way that I was looking at it, and that makes me notice something that I hadn't noticed. That's what, you know, real conversation is. And you know, Illich, you know, in the 60s, he was running a language school, among many other things. And there's right. that really wonderful talk that he gave to a group of, you know, these would-be missionaries at the language school, where he says to them, you know, if you learn the words of someone else's language without learning its silences, then that is a form of violence. And you know, that's what he's doing again and again, is trying to, you know, trying to open the possibility that instead of just coming into a situation and, you know, kind of spewing out what I've brought with me, like that situation might be a place in which something happens for us both, for all of us, that none of us was expecting, that none of us brought ready formed to the situation. And that's, you know, you and David were talking about what Illich thinks mission is. That's what he thinks is the thing that can be redeemed from within the horror show of what has often been done in the name of mission.
That's the salvage work, right? Inside of message, yeah.
Yeah. And so the example that you brought of that one liner about, you know, the best sign of bad times is the amount of food that has to be bought, like part of the work that charge is doing is not just showing us ourselves in the mirror of the past, it's showing us that somewhere between there and here we went through the looking glass into a world which is upside down by comparison to what it's been like to live in almost any other time or place. And, you know, where it's really mind-boggling to be confronted with the idea that needing money in order to feed yourself is a sign of something being badly wrong, rather than a sign of prosperity and progress and the rest of the kind of standard narrative of how we got to where we are. And now, I was thinking when you were saying about, you know, the no that you hear in Illich, I suddenly remembered the phrase that became very big in the anti-globalization movement in the 90s, and that was actually the title of Paul Kingsnorth's first book, One No, Many Yeses.
Yeah.
And that phrase was coined by Gustavo Esteva. And I don't think anyone's really pointed this out, but I mean, Gustavo had that great gift for making slogans. What he does there is to take the diagram from Illich's vernacular values, the three dimensions of political choice, where he draws like two of the dimensions. There's a kind of left-right axis, and then there's a sort of front-back axis, and they run, you know, from one pole to another. But the third dimension is weird. The way I imagine it always is, I think it's actually drawn the other way up in the book, but in one direction, it's a single line pointing upwards, which is the industrial. In the other direction, instead of a single axis, it's branching and curving in lots of directions, and it's labeled the vernacular. So when Gustavo says one no, many yeses, he's affirming the same thing that Illich is saying there. So it's a no to that singular, you know, planned, projected, converging path of how everything is headed the same way, just some of us are further ahead along that single line than the other. And it's a yes to all of the many different ways. You know, Wendell Berry's thing of the only manual for Spaceship Earth that could or should ever exist is 10,000 human cultures living in place. That's the many yeses. And that's precisely what can't be heard if you think that a yes needs to be a plan, needs to be a formula. And again, when you were reminding us of the birthday of development and it being Truman's inauguration speech, where this concept that then structures the relationship between everybody in the world is kind of launched on the world by the American president. I was thinking of the story of at some point Illich was talking with Jacques Maritain, the Catholic philosopher who was, I think, something of a mentor to him. And Maritain is saying, this word planning that I've seen, I don't understand it. What is it? And Illich is trying to explain it to him. And finally, Maritain says, ah, I understand. It is a new version of the sin of pride. And it's the, you know, the need for a one yes.
Amen.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Oh, so on that, I'm laughing too, because I'm just, that's a great, I love that story. And it just reminded me, you know, one of the things that dialectic between Illich's no and his yes, he often talks about the advent, this kind of encounter that is the best of Christian mission. But it's not just about mission, it's also just about, you know, life and how you relate to the other. But he talks about it in terms of surprise, and surprise almost in the sense of the way you hear a story or a joke and you laugh, you get it, right? And I remember in Brazil, there was so much that happened between that initial, Cláudio introducing me to Illich by showing me, basically telling me no, you know, through Illich, right? But then there was years of lots of that kind of vernacular experiments and just, you know, time of shutting up and spending time with Cláudio and people in Brazil and my own neighbors and learning. And there was a moment, if I fast forward, this would have been like 2010, where our family, we're moving to Birmingham, where we now live, for me to study and about Illich. And so the community there around Cláudio, that's called Casa da Videira, literally House of the Vine. And this community guy, it was kind of my sending away But it also sort of turned into this, they started playing around with this idea of reverse missionary. You know, like you came to us and you had a backpack full of ideas and all this kind of thing. And you're one of us is kind of what they're saying. And there was this was just classic, man. And there was this moment where we actually, there were a number of us gathered in person in Claudio and Katja's living room. And then there were other people joining on Skype. And it was a kind of, wasn't like super formal, but there was this moment where they were sending me back. And in the middle of that, Claudio was praying in Portuguese, but I'll translate. And he said, "And God, we thank you for Sam, who was the best failure of a U.S. missionary that we ever met," in the middle of the prayer, man. And that to me was like getting the joke, right? It wasn't about, I don't have a part to play. I can't ever cross a threshold. But it's about the difference between reading To Hell and Good Intentions and being around their table. Those are just two different universes. But I'm curious, because one of the things that we've been asked to sort of riff on or explore is, how you've personally have experimented with Illich. Because I know you've done some, you know, School of Everything, or is it School for Everything? I'm not sure if I got the title exactly right. But I'm really interested to know what has been your way of not just thinking about Illich, but just sort of living with and after Illich. How have you found traction with that?
Stumblingly, which I think might be appropriate. There's a wonderful book by Lee Hoynatsky, who was Illich's oldest friend, called Stumbling Towards Justice, which is like listening to the other end of a telephone conversation where Illich's books are one end of it. And there are a number of different people who you can have that experience with. I mean, reading Barbara Duden's work, or even Lewis Hyde's The Gift, you get this sense of listening to the other end of a conversation with Illich. But I did see David Blower in the chat asked about, you know, is Illich really as negative a thinker as we're making him out to be? And you know, the example there is chapter 6 of Deschooling Society, which is where he sketches out this proposal for learning webs. And so me and Mary Harrington, who's now better known for her very thought-provoking book, Feminism Against Progress. But when we were still in our 20s, along with three other folks who we had met at that sort of period in our lives, had a go with the backing of the Young Foundation and Channel 4 and some dot-com investors at realizing the sketch in chapter 6 of Deschooling Society for creating a sort of database, and that Illich literally uses that word, which at the beginning of the 1970s was fairly avant-garde of him, through which people can share offers and requests for learning and be matched up with people near them who are interested in learning the same thing they are, or who can offer a skill or a resource which they need. And so that was School of Everything. And we didn't achieve very much with it. But one interesting thing that happened as the news of that started to spread was that one day to our office, addressed to me, arrived a package inside which was a 200-page photocopied manual from something called the Learning Exchange, which had been created in Chicago in the early 1970s by, amongst other people, John McKnight, who you and David mentioned 2 weeks ago, because he's one of the originators of asset-based community development. And the Learning Exchange. So John McKnight had actually been at the seminars in Cuernavaca the summer that led to Deschooling Society. So one of the things that was happening, as I understand it, at the Center for Intercultural Documentation in Cuernavaca was that each summer there was a kind of gathering of all sorts of people really around a particular theme. Some of them Illich's friends, some of them people who had just heard about what was going on there and wanted to check out this scene. And it was this kind of informal think tank. And so each year there would be a theme, and then several people would end up going away and writing books that arose from the conversations that had gone on over those weeks together in Cuernavaca. And in the case of the summer where Deschooling Society got written out of it, one of the other things that happened was that John McKnight went back to inner city Chicago and implemented a version of what Illich describes in chapter 6 of Deschooling Society, using a card file database and a telephone number and volunteers, which ran through to the mid 80s and had, I think, 30,000 people in the city listed on its card files at its peak. And presumably the experience of that fed into his later work and asset-based community development. And part of, I think ABCD is a good example of applying Illich's kind of negation of the usual assumptions to arrive at something positive and constructive. It's this thing which says, well, look, just about everything that's done in the name of development, from the scale of community development to the scale of international development, starts by looking at situations, looking at people, looking at places through a lens of what's missing. I remember a community worker on a council estate in Bristol describing this to me, and he lived on this estate. He'd lived there for 30 years. And he said, yeah, in recent years, we've had, this was kind of in the Blair era, we've had these projects coming in to work with the kids on our estate that have been, getting these chunks of funding, and they're coming here to do these workshops or whatever it is. I always get talking to the people who are coming running the project, and I ask them what they know about our estate. And they can tell me all of the indicators of deprivation, but they've no idea that there's actually a really high proportion of people on this estate who have university degrees, because there are lots of recent migrants who are highly educated people who've arrived from other parts of the world who are living in this poor area, who even by formal terms have lots of accredited knowledge. And his point was the lens through which all of these projects were getting funded was a lens that required people to be described in terms of what was lacking, in terms of their needs, in terms of their deprivation. And McKnight's move with ABCD is to say, what if we start instead by looking at what might be being overlooked or undervalued, all of the assets and capacities that are already present in a place, and then just look for the little moves in which we can connect them up differently or describe them differently so that possibilities arise from it. And that's absolutely, that's a reflection in practice of the invitations that Illich is making. So yes, I think someone was saying in the chat, wouldn't want to overstate the negativity.
Yeah.
It's only from a certain angle that Illich looks like a negative.
And I think those examples that you gave around your own experiments and then drawing that line back to Chicago, and McKnight's, that's it. And once again, we're talking about through which lens are you looking at agency and how you play a part. So I think this is really good and interesting how we're creating the space for the yes. I very much see McKnight's, when I think about Illich's, I encountered him in Brazil and through Gustavo Esteva, grassroots postmodernism. It was only later that I encountered McKnight. And McKnight was, it was all about saying, it's not about being anti-institutional or even anti-system, but just saying, if we only look there, first of all, those are counterfeit goods, to say that care is only a commodity that you get from a system. Now, you're misunderstanding care. Illich liked to say only people care, and institutions can and should enable people to care. But if you only look at, that classic move, let's profile what's wrong with a neighborhood. What's wrong? Basically, one way I've heard McKnight flip it is start with what's strong, not just with what's wrong, right? If you want to have a a rhymey way to remember it. And that's not about, what's interesting to me is the places and communities that I know here. My work on the ground is very much informed by ABCD. Mm-hmm. I work 2 days a week as a green connector with an organization in another neighborhood. That organization is called Open Door. So the church there realized they needed to have a kind of third space, some other kind of bumping space to connect and make visible. I think that's, make the invisible visible, all those gifts that are in the neighborhood. So Open Door really is a kind of social platform for connecting. It's not service provision. And you know, those services, they can be people, if they need something, a medical intervention or benefit support, those are things that can and should exist, and they can be signposted. But we tend to ask questions like, what's your jam? What's your passion? What do you like to do? If you had three neighbors that support you to do anything you want, what would you want to do together? You know, those kinds of questions that are kind of roomy, that allow people to go, I'm a carpenter, or I'm a gardener, or, you know, people from, I speak Arabic, and, you know, there's a lot of skill. But I'm fascinated by, again, this lens and your quote that you shared this week about how we play our part without overreaching, but without also deprecating all those gifts that are around us, right? Open Door is one thing I do. Also, in our immediate neighborhood, where we've lived since 2016, after I finished the PhD, it was interesting timing because we moved here literally, it was like a month after the Brexit referendum. And some other story. That's great, Perry. Thanks for sharing that. So we moved to Summerfield, B16, about a month after the Brexit referendum. And there was this kind of shockwave of, it just brought to the surface a lot of hate. There's a lot of hate messages, you know, immigrants aren't welcome, this kind of thing. Now, being a white American who speaks English as a first language, you know, I could pass in that sense. I also was not from here. And our neighborhood, it's one of these neighborhoods where there's no majority population. You know, when our daughter was in primary school here, 44 languages were spoken at her school. You know, so it's that kind of just crucible of diversity. And yet we were new here, Brexit referendum happened. And so one of those, we just generally wanted to get to know our neighbors, but also how do you cross that threshold? How do you meet neighbors in a new place, but also recognize what Illich called, you know, the humility of the guest, which could be another thread we talk about, because there's hospitality, but there's also, how do you learn the humility of the guest? Long story short, we connected the local church parish hall here, the Anglican church. We opened things up. We started at our home to do a few things, but we quickly realized actually that that's really complicated about crossing that threshold for a lot of people. And we needed to have a more neutral space, or space that isn't private, crossing that threshold. But we started what we call neighbor nights on the first Wednesday of the month. And we just had it last week. It's been going since 2016. And what's really interesting about that space, we call the strap line of neighbor nights being neighbors on purpose. You know, and we often say, basically, it's a bring and share. That's like a bring and share with a town hall meeting at the end. And we say, If you want to rant, there's nothing wrong with ranting. But for example, litter is a perennial problem here. If you want to rant about litter, you go to the ward forum. That's what that exists for, to speak to counselors. And it is a very different energy. But if you want to organize a litter pick, come to neighbor nights. You know, if you're concerned about like the way parks and rec aren't doing things, you can go to the ward forum. If you want to start a community garden, come to neighbor nights. But anyway, and so we play with this idea of being neighbors on purpose, that Dougal, if you and I live in B16 or Gillett Road, we're neighbors by accident. And this is where I think this to me is one of the deepest yeses that I find in Illich's work about the neighbor and encountering the other is what are the conditions that make it possible to be neighbors on purpose? Not by accident, where we're just a statistical we that happen to inhabit the same postcode or profile of needs and et cetera, but a convivial we, where we have this lovely dance of offers and ask. I can do that. Oh, you teach guitar. Oh, I know a neighbor over here who wants to learn guitar. You see what I'm getting at? And what I love about that is every neighborhood, if you scratch below the surface, that treasure's there. That's my hunch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you used the word dance. Mm-hmm. I always think about this in terms of, you know, the art of invitation, which is a phrase that Lucy Neal and the others who were part of the Encounters group kind of framed that for me a few years back. They ran a series of events called The Art of Invitation. And that felt like it named something really important, because invitation is a clue to what agency without power over looks like. I remember, you know, so one of the organizations that I was responsible for bringing into being was an agency called Space Makers, which grew out of a meetup group that I was running in London at the time of the financial crisis, where, you know, Woolworths had just gone bust. What to do with empty shops on the high street was kind of a big question. And I was just getting people together once a month to ask, you know, how can we use the amount of space that is sitting open in our cities just now to reimagine what we're actually doing with spaces in our cities? And it's a long story, but the second project we ended up doing was working with Lambeth Council to create something called the West Norwood Feast, which is a community owned and run street market, which is still going, you know, whatever it is, 12 years and one pandemic later, on the first Sunday of every month in West Norwood. And for the first year and a half, we as Space Makers were the sort of incubators of that and the interface between the council, who were giving us a bit of funding to do that project, and the local people who were bringing the project to life. And I remember we would have, you know, every Tuesday night at 6:15, we'd have an open meeting in the pub by the railway station. And anyone could come along to that with an idea, with all, you know, wanting to get involved. And one of the early meetings, one of the council officers we were working with came up to me quietly at the end and said, "Dougal, we always think you have to drag people to get them to meetings, but you've got all these people and they look really happy to be here." And I remember thinking, literally, I didn't say it to him, but it was a physical kind of image of, well, if someone comes up to me and drags me, what do? I dig my heels in. And it's literally that, you know, within the logic of the state and the logic of the market, the practice of invitation withers, because you're used to being able to do things by either the coercive power of money, because of people's dependence on money in order to feed and house themselves, or the coercive power of the state. And, you know, as those things extended over more and more of the social landscape of modern societies, one of the things that happens is that, you know, the way that things get done when people come together for reasons other than because they're being paid to or told to gets marginalized. It becomes like a muscle that we're not using enough and starts to wither. And so it was, you know, almost unimaginable at first for some of the people we were working with from the local authority side that there was another way of engaging with the public. And meanwhile, that same night at the meeting, someone said to me, "Oh, I went to the Norwood Forum the other day, and that was full of people shouting at each other. This is much more friendly," which is kind of my version of the same story that you told. Yeah. And it's not that there isn't the need for those agonistic spaces where we encounter each other in the roles of kind of council officer and service user. You know, sure, that's part of the story, but the kind of stretching the imagination that there might also be other ways in which we encounter each other, through which things become possible that wouldn't be achieved if we were operating by the logic of the state or the market. You know, that's always been for me, like what trying to put the stuff that I've learned from Illich and his friends into practice feels like. And just that bit about, you know, the crossing the threshold of the home, that was really interesting, the way that you described that. And it reminded me of Ray Oldenburg's book, The Great Good Place, which is a sort of fascinating sociological description of the disproportionate importance of the convivial pockets within modern societies, whether it's the pub or the coffee shop or the hairdressers. You know, it can be culturally modulated in different ways. And one of the things he says is that when Americans moved to the suburbs in the 50s, a great kind of dying of conviviality happened, because the new mode of socializing was one couple inviting two other couples over for dinner in their home. Yeah. And that raised the stakes really high compared to people hanging out at the local, whatever it was, whether it was the barbershop or a bar or whatever it was, which was the older mode of socialization, but that was missing from the landscape of the new suburbs. And it also made me realize, you know, I'm sitting here in the old shoe shop in Ostervola, and we live upstairs above the shoe shop. But actually, it was really important to us when we found this space to have a space that wasn't fully the private home that we could invite people into, a space which has three generations of history of everyone having been brought here by their mum to get shoes when they were in school. And therefore, there is a habit of crossing this threshold and a curiosity about what's now happening with the space, all of which make it possible for us to make invitations in a different way than if this was simply and had always been simply a private home. And you sort of brought that into focus for me, actually, with your story. So thanks for that.
Man, thank you. And I'm just, people are riffing on that. And I'm just reminded this, what you're describing, I love that phrase, convivial pockets, because it gives a language for certain patterns around the home. I'm aware, like for my, still remember my grandparents, it was the front porch. So you're sitting, you're not, the door's not closed. People, it's that semi-permeable membrane where people can have, if you're sitting on the front porch, you're telling your neighbors, if you come by, there's lemonade, we'll have the cards out and you're welcome to drop in.
Yes.
Very different social space, isn't it? And also there's a, so I can't remember the name, but of the sociologist talked about the invention of air conditioning, how it destroyed that space. Because on the front porch, people would have had fans and been outside in the evening and screen porch to keep the bugs out. But it was the air conditioning. Suddenly it's no longer permeable because you're behind the brick and mortar, right? And I'm also aware, now that I'm thinking about it, just how deep that pattern is, I notice in my neighborhood around these convivial pockets, bumping spaces. Neighbor nights is once a month. Every Tuesday, there's actually a movement called Places of Welcome that's fascinating. That's very much place, any space can become a place of welcome. The only condition is that it's got to be for everyone. So again, it's not targeting anyone, which is interesting in itself because it takes away that stigma of, you know, why are you coming? You know, or it doesn't have to be because of need, but it's 2 hours every Tuesday from 10 to 12. And there's hot drinks and usually snacks, and people have made it their own. So Place of Welcome is, it is that threshold. It's that convivial pocket. But what's fascinating, one of the neighborhood matriarchs, she had this line that she often mentions, but it kind of sums it up. Everyone needs something to do and someone to do it with. Right? Yeah. I mean, can't you imagine when you talk about in the barrio, when people would, Gustavo Esteva talks about how he would kind of riff on Illich or drip feed, and people are like, yeah, that's what we do, you know. It's that sense of everyone needs something to do and someone to do it. And you can't commodify that. You can't, you know, it has to be, there has to be certain kinds of flow in a space of people knowing those needs and offers and knowing how to connect. So place of welcome is one. Also, there's a network of what we call mother gardens.
Yeah.
And when we open this up in the round, I'm sure there are going to be stories that can, I'm really interested to see how this looks in other people's patches. Mother gardens began, there's a guy, Felipe Molina, and he just had a vision, you know, allotments have their own culture, but again, talk about, it's a pretty hard threshold, and allotments can be hard to get in and, you know, hard to access. And sometimes community gardens, people have this question of, am I in, who's it for? So mother gardens, he started calling them, let's create mother gardens, because a pattern in the garden is that it's designed to spread. Mm. When you know, the strawberry throws its runner to propagate the next plant and you cut it and then you give it away. So when you spend time in the garden, the most natural thing in the world, if you're learning from the plants, is to be generous and for it to flow. So we began to play, Felipe coined the idea, and in COVID, as you can imagine, it just went crazy, because those informal convivial networks of ways that people have something to do and someone to do it with, it was about way more than growing food, but you know, it's about connection, it's about imagination. And so Mother Gardens, I would say, are one of those other spaces, man, where I think this kind of these kinds of encounters and these kinds of yeses are, it's like a microclimate for different possibilities. And I don't think that we should, the thing about what I love, and I just want to go back, one no many yeses. Many yeses means we're not, you can say that neighbor nights, place of welcomes and mother gardens, school for everything and these experiments all kind of manifest in a gift and a visibility and a neighborliness that's, you just can't bottle it and sell it, right? It's just, it's there and it's valuable to be shared. But it's true. I mean, two things are true, paradoxically. I'm not saying they're a panacea for everything, right?
Yeah.
It's not a panacea for world peace, and mother gardens are not a panacea for a broken global food system. But the many yeses means by itself, it doesn't have to be.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be. That's the Promethean temptation, to think that the experiment has to be the absolute solution, right? So I think there's just something really liberating about Illich's yes, that there are many yeses. Mm. What's yours? You know, that's, I think that's the invitation.
All right. Sam and Dougal, thank you so much for sharing the conversation. I'm going to put my, I'm going to stick my neck in and open up the space to a broader conversation. This has landed quite deeply in questions of what conviviality looks like in the cracks in our neighborhoods, where our kind of where on the surface of it, our way of life is very managed and atomized. The chat's kind of sprung to life with different thoughts and examples on this subject that people have from where they are. So I'd like to open it up to any other voices. Firstly, for questions that you might want to send back to Dougal and or Sam, but also to open it up for anybody's reflections on where they see conviviality sprouting up in the cracks in their own communities, what kind of examples or wisdom or stories anybody has from where they are. So please, if you would like to contribute, just wave your hand. John? I see you waving. Would you like to speak into the space?
Yes, just to say thank you for the organizers of this encounter. It's not anything special. I just wanted to say thank you for what I'm hearing from this discussion, because I'm a spiritual, a religious missionary, an African, and I have lived in different cultures, and now I'm living in England. And as a religious missionary, we have been battling with that issue of intercultural living. And I was very happy when I heard Mr. Hine say that to learn a language without its silences can lead to some kind of a form of violence. Very impressive, because that is something that some of us missionaries don't have, or not, we are not aware of. And so sometimes we become problem in the community when we do not really listen. When we encounter other cultures, we don't listen, and we don't see, we don't hear the silences in languages. And that intercultural living, as I see it in our communities, is well constructed, but it doesn't come so clean. It doesn't come so clean for us, you know, doesn't come so clean. But I'm really getting some points out of this, how to handle such issues. You just have to be patient, learn.
Thank you. I'm honored that you came. And as a transition, I know, David, there are a few other people that wanted to speak, but I just wanted to say I'm very honored that you came. In our parish here, St. Patrick's, which is my parish of residence, I've often said to Father John that, so it's St. Patrick's, it would have been a, you know, Irish immigrant parish.
Parish, yeah.
Almost would have been, it came this close to being closed a few years ago because people moved away. And here's one of the ironies of living in Birmingham, that it was the African diaspora that basically saved this parish. So, you know, Father John is from Ghana, and the sisters who live there are from Nigeria. I don't know what the exact percentage, but it's about 50% African, 20% Eastern European, a few British, and one American Brazilian family. But I say to Father John, part of the yes that I think we are trying to gesture to with Illich, I say, when we gather for Mass, it's like Pentecost on every Sunday. There is something about the beauty of gathering. So I just wanted to say, it's also messy. How do you discover the gifts and learn to listen when there's that much difference? But there is also a beauty in that gathering. David, I'm going to pass it to you because I see that there might be a few other hands up.
All right. I'm looking to see who else would like to contribute their thoughts or experiences or reflections. Does Melvin have a hand up? Okay, Melvin.
Well, yeah, thanks again for this very interesting conversation. I just wanted to kind of, you know, what we were kind of the question of how to create these kind of spaces, and just wanted to share my experience. I lived in Montreal for many years, 14 years doing my PhD and such, and then I, a couple of years ago, moved to the small village in northwestern Ontario, you know, kind of middle of nowhere, anyways, outside of Thunder Bay. And it's been about 2 years ago, I met a woman and we got married, and it's lovely and that's all great. But it's been a very interesting experience because I rediscovered Illich kind of during the pandemic, really. And it was something that had been in my head, actually going back to when I was 15, listening to David Keeley's documentaries on ideas. And so over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years of sort of Illich filling my head and kind of thinking through that again, and then moving to this place and trying to realize that in a new community. And it's a very rural areas that I live in, and it's been a struggle because as much as I dislike Facebook, these community Facebook groups that each sort of little township has been one of the most sort of the best ways of actually meeting people and connecting to people. And, you know, there are groups of, you know, of trade, you know, if like you can trade you know, things you, you know, either services or things you produce, many, you know, just ways of, and yet I struggle with that because I really don't like that, you know, relying on that technological mediation. And yet it has become such a powerful way and such a sort of ubiquitous way that people connect. And I'd be curious about other people's thoughts about that sort of that contradiction of you know, feeling, you know, wanting a really an in-person, more traditional kinds of connections. And I mentioned in the chat, you know, the decline of the public house, of the place where people could just go. And when I was young, that still existed, and I would go and I would meet people that I didn't know, and I would just sort of just start talking to people, and I got to know so many people, and that was such a important part of my growing up. And yet it has declined to such a degree that we end up being reliant on Facebook as a way to connect to people, and it's so lacking in so many ways. And yet it seems like that's kind of all that we have, you know, in a way. I know I need to do more to try to create in-person gatherings, but at the same time, it's a struggle. It's a struggle. So
I'm reminded of a line from one of Illich's later texts where he says something along the lines of, you know, the only way that it's possible to sustain and endure the contradictions necessary in modern life, such as that I am writing this on a Motorola laptop whilst making systems critique, is through friendship. And I think that part of that is, you know, avoiding any kind of puritanism of what tools or technologies, because of the time and place we find ourselves in, might be what comes to hand in order to try and create these pockets of conviviality. And I was smiling along because, you know, in our town of 1500 people here in rural Sweden, the local Facebook group is also a very important way through which people end up finding their way through the door when David Blow was here doing a concert in the shoe shop in July, for example. So, you know, these are the things, the kind of paradoxical, troubling things that are part of the patchwork that we find ourselves starting from. And it's a bit like the old Irish joke about the tourist who pulls up at the side of the road and asks the local for directions, and the local shakes his head and says, "Well, if I were you, I wouldn't be starting from here." And I think that's a kind of very Illichian joke, because, you know, we're all starting from places which, to a greater or lesser degree, we wouldn't choose to be starting from, even if we're also starting from very sheltered and privileged places within the, you know, the space of the world as it is just now. And we have to kind of we have to forgive each other and learn to forgive ourselves the kind of the contradictions and the things that might feel hypocritical or whatever it is. But not, you know, not also not lose sight of the other bit that you brought, which is the kind of the genuine sense of loss, that there have been things not that long ago within our own experience or the experience of people we knew that, you know, were more amenable to conviviality than the ways in which we find ourselves having to find ways of making life work now. And part of the importance of holding on to that loss is because, you know, we can tell the stories of things that were lost, and those stories may turn out to be seeds out of which new versions of the thing that you have that distinct memory of the public house at its best having been. And if we lose the stories, then we don't carry the seeds which might then grow under other conditions in times to come.
There's a reflection in the chat from Hannah. This was a little bit earlier about cars and roads and the ways that our transport systems have divided up our lives. And in that sense, the more privileged and wealthy folks are, the more in danger of the less we need one another, the more we inoculate ourselves from encounter. But we all live with this kind of infrastructure wherever we are. I'm wondering, well, firstly, Hannah, please feel free to add to my thoughts. The question in my mind on this is to do with how do we not find ourselves in a disheartening battle with, you know, non-convivial infrastructure. How do we walk around it? How can conviviality not be an endless crushing battle against the machine, as it were? I wonder if there's any wisdom on that kind of thing.
I see Claudio wasn't able to manage the hand up function, but he's been trying to jump in here somewhere too. It'd be lovely to hear from the friend who introduced Sam to Illich.
Well, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. And thank you, Sam, for organizing and Dogo to share. And once I was quoted by Sam, you know, I need to humble myself and put me back in the place. So as I listen, the question is, there's an expression that we use here, and I'm living in Portugal now, by the way. Okay, I moved from Brazil last year, actually 2001. I don't know, one year ago, I came to Portugal. And in many, many, many senses was an opportunity to relearn and reset myself, you know, out of the comfortable zone that we have created, you know, after years of creating and experimenting on convivial spaces and living in the cracks of the system. And I really have problems with this kind of idealism of trying to create an alternative system, alternative blah, 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 whatever. You know, I do not believe that any other system can replace what we have presently, but that life in a deeper sense is experimenting the cracks of the system. There's no perfect system. So all systems will have cracks, and we need to learn how to live, not by expanding our experience towards, you know, something bigger, but going deeper into those cracks and learn, you know, how to live there and experience the fullness of life there. So after years being in Brazil, and Sam gave an image that was very positive, and I thank you, Sam, for that. And we realized that it was a time for us to move. Because that is another, you know, aspect that is, life is about moving all the time. We never, you know, can feel comfortable enough unless we are in the hell, you know. When you're in the hell, so we are very comfortable, warm, you know, but it's a flame that's coming in your direction. So I don't like the idea of being comfortable too much time. I like to feel that I'm in movement. So as a community, and living and experience what I called an accidental community. I do not believe in intentional communities also, okay? I think that community is a gift that's given to you. We have experienced a very successful, you know, community that was not a bubble. Mostly during the COVID, we were exactly the reverse of a bubble. We were protected, we were, you know, safe during that. But during the COVID, we just became a success, you know, and that could be a trap for us. So we realized that, okay, we show that what we call a prophetic way of showing how things could be, and not let this become from a movement into a monument, you know, that we can celebrate and see, look how we are good and blah, blah, blah. So I'm now in a very similar situation of that Sam was years ago in Brazil. I moved to Portugal. And for the first time in many years, you know, I have the comfort of being fragile, you know, of not knowing, of being the guest, you know, and taking care of not step on the flowers of the other person's gardens, you know, trying to learn, you know, because Brazil and Portugal are divided by the same language. So we believe we speak the same language, but it's totally different. So learning new expressions, learning other ways, and admiring, most of all, learning to admire, you know, the colonizer, you know. We were colonized by the Portuguese, and we're learning to love those, you know, and learning how to experience the echoes of conviviality that were once part of this country. And what I made, just an example, you know, I arrived here fearing, you know, of not being able to be a neighbor. That was my point. And many times I called Sam saying, Sam, I have no clue how to arrive here and to be a neighbor. I want to be a neighbor, but have no clue how. So I live in a small house with a garage, you know, no soil. But I decide I will make this a garden. You know, that's the only thing that I know how. And I started working in front of my house, you know, preparing some pallets and making this a beautiful place, starting planting. And one day, for my surprise, one of the neighbors approached me and said, hey, what you're doing here is exactly what we need. Nobody's doing this anymore. And then she became this neighbor, my best friend in Portugal. She started connecting me to people. I found another American guy here that's so frustrated, you know, with his experience, trying to do something relevant and do something good and not being understood by people. And then I found another one. And then I found a school where I could inspired by Sam's experience of the mother garden, you know, start a mother garden, and we call a regenerative garden, because the soil was so bad that I said, let's work on the infrastructure and take care of the soil, or in the tradition that we follow in Hebrew, Adama, you know, the fertile soil that was once lost. And what happened is that a community of people started coming together. And last month I was evaluating, I will stop here because I'm talking too much already. And I started evaluating my sabbatical year, that was last year, so October to October. And then I realized I have no Brazilians that are my friends here in Portugal. I only have Portuguese friends that I'm learning again, that I'm, you know, creating cracks. And our house now, in our small garden last month, I'm very proud, we have harvested 92 kilos of food in this small garden, the space of two cars, you know, and with chickens and managing our garbage, and now creating a movement of who said this is rubbish, you know, that's the same that we are having there in Birmingham. And I can humbly say that, you know, based on Sam's experience and putting myself in the fragile position, not someone that has something to teach, but someone that's had a lot to learn, you know, I found my crack here, you know, and the crack is growing. And I hope in 1 or 2 years, our street will be a little different. Our friends, our old friends, a lot of elderly people here around, a lot of immigrants, a lot of Africans and Indians and other people in the surrounds, we will be experiencing all the effects of this little crack that we are creating. So once I understood that it was just to give how to use an opportunity, I would say, be careful. Try to not step on the flowers of the other person's garden. Try to be the neighbor you would like to have. And do not make a propaganda of yourself. Go there and do something practical. Most of all, take care of the soil, take care of, breathe the air, and enjoy coffee with people. And by the way, there's a lot of bars here in Portugal. So everybody's on the bars. Nobody's inviting you to come for lunch in your, and by the way, Portuguese do not like you at their homes. They like to meet you in the cafe. So this is a fantastic experience here, is this. Okay, thank you very much. I spoke too much. Bye-bye.
You didn't speak too much, Claudio. That's a beautiful picture. Thank you so much for sharing. We've just gone past the 9:30 point, 9:30 where I am anyway, all kinds of different times, wherever you all are. So thank you all for gathering. And we will return in 2 weeks for a final conversation. And it will be an open conversation between whoever shows up. But thank you once again for all coming. And thank you to Dougald and Sam for bringing us into this place.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Marcus.